This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the countries of the Middle East prepare for a peace conference, one of America's most esteemed investigative journalists has completed an exposé of Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. My guest is Seymour Hersh, author of the new book, The Samson Option, Israel's Nuclear Arsenal and American Foreign Policy. Hersh describes this book as a study of how Israel became a nuclear power in secret, and how that secret was shared, sanctioned, and at times willfully ignored by the top political and military officials of the U.S. since the Eisenhower years. Seymour Hersh is a former New York Times reporter who is currently on special assignment with the paper. It was Hersh who broke the stories of the My Lai massacre, how the CIA spied on American citizens, and Noriega's connection to drug trafficking. Hersh is the author of books about Henry Kissinger and the shooting down of the Korean airliner that strayed over Soviet territory. He told me he wrote his new book because everyone knows Israel has nuclear weapons, yet the White House has never wanted to talk about it. Well, why not?
Well, what are you going to do? You're the president of the United States. You're running for re-election, let's say. Let's say you're Jimmy Carter in 79. And there's evidence, as I write about in my book, that the Israelis and the South Africans secretly conducted at least one, and I think I write there were three, tests of low-yield neutron devices in the South Atlantic. And you record it, and your intelligence community records it. What are you going to do? You've just had Camp David. You've just signed a peace agreement nurtured a peace agreement between Sadat of Egypt and Begin of Menachem Begin of Israel. You've been shown up in Afghanistan to have misjudged the Soviets, who apparently are tougher than you initially gave them credit for. Your policy of human rights, your wonderful policy, basically, instinctively, that is, of trying to push human rights around the world, has sort of backfired in your face. You want to be reelected. You've got a problem going in Iran in terms of hostages and all sorts of upheavals there. Are you really going to take on the Israelis over nuclear weapons in right before an election and have all that heat from Congress and what frankly is a pretty considerable lobby, the Jewish lobby? You're not going to. You're just going to look the other way. In every case, there's always a reason for the American president to have other priorities, and he does.
Why did Israel assume it was in its best interest to keep the arsenal a secret?
Oh, I think they're going to drop that now, by the way. I think my book's going to flush them out a little bit, and the peace conference is going to have to flush them out. I think in the beginning there was a genuine fear. Don't forget, the Israel of the 40s and 50s was a socialist country, Ben-Gurion, a Zionist country, had tremendous support from Jews in the diaspora, and particularly from American Jews who were liberal by nature, more anti-bomb, anti-war. And I think, particularly given the left-leaning of the country and of Israel in the 40s and 50s, the kibbutz notion, collective living, all those socialism, I think there was a terrific fear in the early days that if they talked publicly about what they wanted to do, they would lose their means of support. There was no indigenous economy or money base in the first years, and there still isn't very much. They depend totally on external aid, privately from Jewish groups and publicly from the United States.
If you're just joining us, my guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, and his new book, The Samson Option, is about the secret nuclear weapons program of Israel.
And let me say, yeah, an American foreign policy, because right, it's also about what the Americans did with it. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You say that President Kennedy got permission for an American inspector to examine the nuclear plant once each year, but the Israelis built a false control room and other fake sites to fool America. How did they do that? How did they get away with it?
Well, first of all, it's the use of simulators, simulated training facilities, is common in pilot training. We all know, we've seen movies or news television accounts of how pilots are trained in simulated cockpits. Similarly, when we train technicians for a nuclear power plant, they are generally trained in the same sort of a facility, simulated. It's all simulation. So the idea of using a simulated, building a simulated control room wasn't that novel. It just took a lot of guts to get away with it. What they did is underground, they built a control room that gave every appearance of being the control room for a peaceful scientific research plant, as they claimed Dimona was. And when Kennedy insisted and basically demanded in a very nasty exchange of letters with Ben-Gurion, and Kennedy really did believe in nonproliferation. He absolutely was committed to it, as no president was after him. And Kennedy finally persuaded the Israelis that they must let an inspection team in there or they were going to lose any chance of getting American aid, including military aid, as the 60s went along. Well, they just faked us out. They just built a simulated control room. Our team, it was more than one man. It was a team of especially selected men from our nuclear facilities in Oak Ridge and elsewhere, including, I'm sure, some intelligence people. In fact, I know some intelligence CIA people. And they went in and saw the simulated, the fake control room, and bought it.
What can you tell us about how you found out about this fake control room?
Well, actually, in the book, I quote the head of the Americans under Kennedy and Johnson. There were about 10 inspections between 1961 and 1969 when they finally were stopped. And they all were led by the same man, a man named Floyd Culler, who was one of the ranking experts in making of a bomb, of the plutonium for a bomb from Oak Ridge. And Culler led the teams, and Culler talked to me. Eventually, I ended up quoting Culler, particularly when I told him there had been a fake plant, and he wasn't astonished. He understood that his inspections, as he said to me, and I quote him as saying, were just sort of the gilding of the lily, that if they really wanted to stop, Americans really were interested in stopping it, they would just go ahead and stop it, stop support for the Israeli bomb program. How I found out about it, Israelis told me.
On the record, off the record?
Oh, no. God, you couldn't. I got a lot of Americans. I felt good about one thing. I got a lot of Americans, ex-CIA guys who retired. This was a narrative, and I started in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. A lot of the old-timers eventually went on the record with me, agreed to let their name be used in my book for the first time. Eventually, because I got some of the older guys to go along, some of the newer guys went along, and eventually I got a lot of people on the record. The Israelis, no way. There's no way I did get one Israeli to talk to me, and that was sort of a rather famous defector from the Israeli intelligence community, a man named Ari Ben Menashe, who's been the subject of much debate in Washington currently because he is publicly alleging, since he's been disaffected from the government a few years ago, he's publicly alleging that there was a 1980 October surprise. And a lot of people have rejected his views pretty abruptly in Washington.
Well, people in Washington and in Israel have tried to discredit him. He used to work for Israeli intelligence, but Israel basically disowned him.
Well, I think it started with him first, but that's okay.
Okay. Yeah. But you trust him?
Do I trust a man who spent 15 or so years in the Israeli intelligence community? No more than any prudent journalist would trust anybody. I will tell you this. I didn't want to see him initially. I was almost done with my book when I was persuaded by a former American CIA official that I'd be making a mistake if I didn't see him. I went and saw him wherever he was living, more or less, not on the lam, but basically in exile. He's not in Israel. And within 5 minutes, it was clear that this man was indeed inside. He knew so much about the bomb program that I'd already learned. Menashe was real. Ben Menashe was real about those things. He then told me some things that I found hard to credit, and I confirmed all of it. And he's a most interesting man.
And let me get to the most controversial thing that he told you that you go with in the book, and that is that Jonathan Pollard, the Israeli spy who was in the United States, gave Israel United States intelligence on Soviet targets and Soviet air defenses. And then Israel used that information to aim nuclear missiles at the Soviet Union.
And then, at the express direction of Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who's still Prime Minister, that information was retyped, sanitized, I guess the technical word is, and passed along to the Soviets.
It's like the ultimate double deal, you know. You're using information to target your missiles at the Soviet Union, then you pass on the information to the Soviet Union to get on their good side.
I think the Israelis would just call it very, sort of realpolitik and prudent. The fact is that Israel has always targeted the Soviets. That was one of the main theses of developing its nuclear program. The Israelis, don't forget, we're talking about men who came from Eastern Europe. They know about the Holocaust. And their goal was never, never again, that wonderful phrase, that they wanted an independent deterrent because they just never thought that in case they would be overrun again, that anybody would help them. Harold Brown, the Secretary of Defense in the Carter years, and a very wise man about such issues, once said to me that he said in essence, I'm abbreviating a little bit what he said, that we had a chance in the early 60s, the only real chance we had to stop Israel from going nuclear was in the early 1960s, when we could have offered them the nuclear umbrella. And he said there were only two problems with that. That is, in other words, we could have told Israel, don't develop nuclear weapons because we will defend you in case of a nuclear crisis with the Soviets or somebody else. Our missiles will come to your aid. And as Brown said, there were two problems with that. One is that the Israelis would not have believed us. And two, we would have been lying. It's a very complicated issue. And Israel's determination was that just as nobody in the West reached out to protect the 6 million Jews, despite all sorts of notification and warnings, we had other fish to fry in that war. Nobody would reach out to protect them. And the Israelis just decided no Arab country would ever attack them with the intent of overrunning them without Soviet aid. And if Israel could let the Soviets know as soon as they were technically proficient, which was in the late 60s and early 70s, that any such attempt would lead to a bomb on Baku in southern Russia, Tbilisi, the oil fields, a one-way F-4 plane to Moscow, something, well, that's a deterrent. And anyway, the point is Israel needed to target the Soviet Union, the kind of intelligence they did not have indigenously, which is satellite intelligence. And that's what Pollard was all about, getting the kind of intelligence they needed to target the Soviet Union.
So let me see if I have this straight. Israel targets the Soviet Union to deter the Soviets from backing an Arab war against Israel. At the same time, Israel passes on secret American intelligence to the Soviets to get on the Soviets' good side, so it's not totally reliant on the United States, kind of playing one superpower against the other. But how does Israel manage to let the Soviets know that they are being targeted by Israeli nuclear weapons and at the same time claim to not have a nuclear arsenal?
They tell them privately. And the Soviets go for it, of course. The Soviets aren't interested in advertising the fact that they're being sort of strong-armed by the Israelis. One senior official told me a couple of years ago, we're going to make nice to the Israelis. It's a great issue for them, with Israel being so having so much weaponry in that part of the world. They'd like to defuse the situation. There's nothing as incongruous as you make it sound. It was a pretty shrewd thing by Shamir. It was really pretty shrewd to try and improve relations, which have improved enormously over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. We're discussing the subject of his new book, The Samson Option, Israel's Nuclear Arsenal and American Foreign Policy. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Seymour Hersh is my guest. What would you say Israel's nuclear strategy is now?
Oh, I think they're sort of confused now. I should also add that one of their targets, of course, their basic targets are the Arab capitals, along with the Soviets. I think they're ready to start. I'd like to think they're ready to be more realistic and start talking more openly about their weapons and also more willing to begin de-escalating. And I think, my book was just published a couple of days ago, and you're going to see the Arab world has not been heard of yet, and we've got a peace conference coming. We're going to see, I think, this issue being put on the table. Or if it's not going to be put on the table, it's not going to be put on the table because of an awful lot of backdoor bargaining about it. I think the Israelis are willing to start maybe even open up their arsenal to international inspection of some kind and to start getting rid of some of the warheads they don't need. After all, they did, as I said earlier, begin their whole program with the idea of aiming at the Soviets. And by the way, I must tell you that one of the things that shook Israel to the core was in the late 60s, after the 67 war, in which they had sort of beat the brains out of everybody in the Middle East, if you remember that famous Six-Day War. They learned that the Soviet Union had added 4 Israeli cities to its target list. Our intelligence community told the Israelis that they were now a target, a nuclear target. I think that was a factor in their decision also to target the Russians in return. It's a real tough game out there.
Yeah. Now, your book was really kept a big secret. I'll say we certainly had no idea it was coming out this week. And I think it wasn't listed in your publisher's catalog.
Right.
And the first notice I saw about the book was a story in the Sunday New York Times, you know, this past Sunday, the same day that Israel decided to commit to going to the peace conference. Is there any, is it coincidence that your book is being timed at the same time as the peace conference?
What do you think? Do you think we can maneuver that?
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, books can be rushed out.
Oh, it was rushed out. I was still writing this book, and I was finishing up checking and double-checking in July. But, you know, there's absolutely no. Look, Louis Brandeis, the famous Supreme Court justice, once said, "Sunshine is the best disinfectant." And I'm not at all going to be persuaded by anybody that my publishing the book now is going to be deleterious to the peace process. It's not. I think it's going to be good for the peace process. I think we can get the issue out. I also think it's very important for the people of Israel to have some idea what's going on in the name of their leadership. You know, even though I think, and I have no illusions, people in Israel, I think, by and large, support the idea of Israel being a nuclear power. But I don't think they realize how nuclear it is, how easy it's going to be to use nuclear weapons in the next war there, how every Air Force base, or most bases, many bases, I should say, and the long-range artillery units have nuclear weapons standardized and ready for use in the stockpile, how they're nuclear landmines along the Golan Heights. They're not armed, but they could be very easily. The holes are dug. And, I you know, it's not, I'm not suggesting Israel's a superpower. It's not. It's just that, but it's a tough little regional power. And I think the people ought to have some say in the Israeli government.
You said that you think that your book might be good for the peace talks. How would more information about Israel's secret nuclear arsenal be good for the peace talks?
I'll take you in good faith that you're asking that question, you know, just because that's your job. I mean, how could it not be? Is the world really better off if there are 3, 4, 5, 1,000 nuclear warheads in Israel ready to go without any public discussion of it? Will the Arabs be willing to settle for any sort of a peace agreement without this issue getting on the table? This issue has to get on the table. It is a basic core security issue of that area. The fact that Israel is nuclear and they're not has to be discussed, and you can't avoid it.
Now, a point that you are strongly making in your book is that Israel's nuclear weapons need to be made public. They need to be discussed openly by countries around the world. Do you oppose Israel having nuclear weapons?
If I'd been a kid, and if I'd been a Shimon Peres, who was so active in this as a 29-year-old kid, a young man working for David Ben-Gurion in Paris in the 50s, I'm convinced I would have thought having a nuclear weapon would be essential, that we would never again be in a position to have a Holocaust. And I can really understand the reasoning of that, and I make no moral judgment about what they're doing. I think it's different. The book's called The Samson Option because, you know, the biblical story about Samson destroying the temple rather than go down himself. And how could you fault that morally? This is a country that had gone, you know, the people had gone through so much, there was so much fear and distrust. And Israel was never able to differentiate between Hitler and Nasser and Brezhnev and Khrushchev. They saw them all as all one continuum. The Holocaust mentality, it's known, as Golda Meir was particularly vulnerable to it. But now you have not just a doomsday bomb, but you have the weapons have become standardized for use by every military unit in case of war. And that's a different kettle of fish. And that's not what the Samson option was. That's an extension of it that I think has potential dangers and needs to be discussed. Look, at the minimum, we have to put it on the agenda. We cannot pretend in America and the rest of the world that it doesn't exist. We're talking about something that exists that everybody is in a conspiracy to pretend doesn't, and that's wrong, and that is also short-sighted.
You end your book by saying basically that if there's another war in the Middle East, there's a good chance it would be nuclear, that the unthinkable would now be thinkable. What has changed that would make another war in the Middle East a nuclear possibility?
Well, just what I've been saying. Instead of having a few bombs at control of the prime minister and he has to authorize it, as in 73, and it's a big deal, you now have Air Force planes and on runways with new nuclear bombs attached to them, ready to go on, you know, on alert. You now have bunkers full of warheads under Tel Nof is one big Air Force base in Israel where they have an awful lot of weapons stored. As I say, the American Intelligence Committee has seen photographs of that. you now have nuclear artillery shells that can be thrown into a long-range cannon. And I think we basically have to begin the process of extricating our head from the sand, from 31 years of sand or 35 years of sand that we've been buried on top of us.
You have objected to how the American government has consistently turned its head and looked the other way when it came to Israel's secret nuclear weapon program. What is it particularly that bothers you about that?
Come on, you got to be kidding. My government has explicit, detailed information on Israel being a major nuclear power at the same time that every year Congress is certifying, based on statements from State Department officials in charge of proliferation, that Israel has never tested a weapon and therefore should be allowed to have foreign aid. What bothers me is my government has been living a lie, and that's wrong. And look, here I am. It's Hirsch living in Plato's Republic again, or being Pollyanna. But this is pretty egregious. This is a question that gets to the core of what kind of world we want for our children. It's been avoiding dealing with the Israeli bomb for 30 years because of more expedient reasons. Political pressure, the perceived lobby, worry about what the Arab world would do, in reaction. The notion, the canard that everybody had, that a lot of American officials told me in the beginning, well, it's really good that we don't go public about it because then we don't rub the Arabs, and I know, the cliche, what do you do, rub their nose in their bombs in the dirt, and therefore the Arabs don't do anything silly. I mean, give me a break. The Arabs have known all about the bombs for years and are desperately trying to do it. They're just not as competent yet, but they will be. You can't forestall the inevitable. Unless we deal with this now, we're going to have 12 countries in that part of the world, in 15 years looking for nuclear, going nuclear.
Well, you're off to London. Let me let you go. Seymour Hersh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Seymour Hersh's new book is called The Samson Option, Israel's Nuclear Arsenal and American Foreign Policy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.